This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Bernadette Brennan is a literary critic, academic, and researcher in contemporary Australian writing. She is the author of a number of publications, and her literary criticism is published widely. In 2017, she published her award-winning literary biography, A Writing Life, Helen Garner and Her Work, through text. Her most recent book is Leaping into Waterfalls, The Enigmatic Gillian Mears, published by Allen & Unwin in 2021. In November 2018, Brennan was the recipient of the inaugural Fellowship for Nonfiction, awarded by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Brennan is also a judge for the prestigious Miles Franklin Award. Bernadette Brennan, what an absolute pleasure it is to speak to you. Thank you for coming on the First Time Podcast Masters Series.
Oh, Masters Series. Excellent. I'm very pleased to be here. Congratulations on getting to the stage of having a Masters
Series. Oh, thank you. It feels good, I tell you that. Look, Catherine and I both had a wish list for this Masters Series. And for you, there's been layers of interest in me wanting to speak to you, your own writing, your path into it and your practice, but also, of course, your two most recent biographies, that of Helen Garner and of Gillian Mears, and also your deep interest in Australian writing in general and the way that you've kind of operated in the industry. And I wonder if you remember the first piece of writing you ever had published.
I actually do, and that's a funny thing because I think maybe a PhD student at the University of Sydney. And I think David Kelly, who was a lecturer in English, might have said to me something like, oh, can you write this piece, you know, 1,500 words? It's for HSC kids and it's on three different poets and 1,500 words max. And I'm saying, 1,500 words on three poets? How do you do this? And not only that, the poets were Udru, Bruce Dorr, and I actually can't remember who the third poet was. So really not thinking much about it, I just churned out this 1,500-word piece, which was probably pretty basic. I haven't brought myself back to read it again. And it went into what was then just the hard copy edition of Sydney Studies in English. And eventually, years later, I got an email saying, oh, are you happy for us to make this digital now? I said, yeah, sure, whatever. And then Copyright Agency contacted me maybe 4 or 5 years ago and said, listen, I think we've got this payment for you. And it was $5,000.
$5,000.
And I'm saying, no, I don't think that could possibly for me. And it was this particular piece. And the reason that it had got so much reading and popularity and therefore I got this royalty was because it was put on, it was for HSC students. So all these students had been using it. And I had totally forgotten I'd done it. I didn't give it much thought and I just churned it out. And I have been too embarrassed to go back and read it.
That's it. What was the focus of your PhD?
It was actually on something called, I was interested in absence and silence in Australian writing. I had an extraordinary teacher, Noel Rowe, and he became one of my closest friends. And then we actually taught together for many years. But he taught me Francis Webb's poetry when I was second year and third year. And I didn't want to do a PhD. I didn't think I wanted to be an academic. I just really loved, you know, studying and writing these things. So when I finished my honours degree, yes, I did very well. And yes, I had the chance of a scholarship, but I thought, I'm not sure that I want to do this. I had two very small children. So I took a year off and I did a editing publishing certificate thinking, oh, well, I'll get into publishing. But actually I thought, no, halfway through the year, I thought, no, I need something more. So I thought I might go back and actually have a look at Webb's poetry and see what I can see in it. And I started to see all these absences and silences and things happening. I couldn't sustain the intensity of it for a whole PhD. It was 100,000 words in those days. So I then thought, I'm going to do something radically different in my second part. I thought I would do Randolph Stowe. But then I started reading Brian Castro's work and I thought, wow, this is interesting. I wonder if I can start to make a conversation between these two very disparate texts. And then this is why I've never published my PhD as a book, because somehow I got it through the markers with some, I wrote the introduction last, made it look like I always intended to do this. But it was 1997 and the Bringing Them Home report came out. And so I read that and I just thought, gee, as someone, a white person in the academy with a voice, how can I write about absence and silence in Australian writing when here is this absolute absence and silence? So my third sort of section was about the Bringing Them Home report and the power of story and silencing and official silencing and what was never silent, but which we chose to do that. So in the end, I gave it an overarching coherence. I pretended that it was all based on Kafka's Great Wall of China with these, you know, blocks of stuff with these absences in between, and I sort of pulled it off somehow. But yeah, so it was a kind of a strange PhD, but it was wonderful. And I still am fascinated by writers who can articulate silence and absence in ways that challenge us. So it really fascinates me. Less is often more, that kind of thing.
That's so interesting, Bernadette. I also wonder, because it strikes me that in all of your work, you have a way of bringing together and making connections between these very disparate either writers or ideas. Did that process of the PhD teach you a new way of approaching that? Or did you start to make the connections first, or did you keep on going with, I'm interested in this, I'm interested in that, and I'll bring it together?
Yes, I'm interested in this, I'm interested in that. Yeah. There's something, I think, because I never, as I say, I never went into academe as an ideal job that this is something I wanted to do. And I do remember going for the interview of my job at Sydney Uni, and I didn't really want it. And it was fantastic because I was so relaxed, but it went for an hour and a half and I came out drenched in sweat. And thought, gee, I really nailed that, but I don't particularly want to teach because my interest was so disparate. And I do remember before I did the PhD, I was at a launch at Glee Books and David Brooks said to me, why aren't you doing a PhD? And I said to him, I looked at the top floor of Glee Books and looked at all the books. I said, because I want to read all of these books. I don't want to just focus on one thing. And he said, that's what a PhD is about. So that got me thinking. So I think it's my interest is always on connections and looking outwards and something bigger and a conversation between books, between writers, between ideas. Yes, I'm extremely interested in Australian culture and literature and identity and all those sorts of things, but I don't think you can stay home to do that. So I think you need to read very broadly and make those conversations. Mm.
Let's talk about reading. Tell me the story of how you became this voracious reader, the types of books that you were reading as a young person. Where did the books come from? I'm interested in this deep love of reading.
Interesting. Yes, I did always love reading. I've just started reading last night, Brenda Niles' memoir about becoming a biographer. And she's talking about how she could read by the age of three. And my mother always insisted that I could as well. And I know that I did play Scrabble with my mother when I was four because I was the youngest child and she of seven. So she basically ignored me pretty much. But she did, when all the others were at school, she did play Scrabble with me and I did used to cheat. I would always turn over the letters to make them blanks and she would let me have about six or seven blanks before she'd pull me up. So I do remember from a very young age reading books because I was bored before I went to school. I remember reading Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice when I was about 10 and I hated it. And I never read Jane Austen again until year 11 when I read Persuasion. I thought, wow, this is really good. So love of reading, I don't know. I think it's just a curiosity. I do get in a foul mood if I haven't got anything to read. Mm. And I like nothing better than being immersed in a book or just getting to the last 10 pages of a book and that sense of please don't end. I don't know where it came from, but I'm glad I've got it. And I think I'm really lucky to have it.
Are you a rereader? Obviously, for things like the PhD, I imagine you would be, but are there books that you come back to every year or every couple of years for pleasure?
I'd like to say that I was. There's certainly books that I've got there thinking I must reread, but I never have time. And I'm impressed by these people who do say, oh, I read Proust every year, or I read this every year, or I read War and Peace every year. But I don't come back often, although when I do, if I come back for a certain project, I love the reread. Yeah.
I find it incredibly, and it seems to get more difficult every year, and I imagine that it's the same for you being in the industry and having books come at you from all different directions, which you're very keen to read, and they start up in piles in all over the place, plus those ones that you want to, that you missed somehow,
exactly.
You know, that you come back to for pleasure. How do you order what you're going to read and when?
So I've actually been a bit constrained the last few years because as a judge for the Miles Franklin, you get about 100 novels to read. So at the moment I'm 91 novels into what we've got. So
wow.
In one sense, it's great because you don't miss books. In another sense, there are already books coming out now, Australian writers, that I think, oh, I really want to read that. And I think I don't have time because I'm reading these others at the moment. And anyway, I'll be reading them in November, that sort of thing. So that sort of constrains me. But the second we get that shortlist organised and then you do another reread and you work out the winner, I have now decided that what I do is for the next probably 2 months, I only read international writers or writers in translation. And that's really, really wonderful. And that I devour because that's pure pleasure. And then I start to read a little bit more. I read nonfiction, a lot of nonfiction, and then I try and start worming my way back into what's going to be the next year's Miles. But I've only got it for one more year. So after that, I'll just probably read whatever I want to read, whenever I want to read, which will be just a thrill.
What a thrill. We're going to come back to talking about the Miles Franklin a little later in the interview. I've lamented and spoken to Tegan Bennett Daylight about this before, that I just cannot remember my reading in the same way that she does. She seems to have this incredible facility for being able to just shuffle back through this library of quotes and books and ideas and plots and narratives. And I wondered how, over your career, especially as a critic and a researcher, your reading skills and instinct, I suppose, have developed, and how or if you take notes as you're reading, or how you build that library in your mind?
That's a great question, because I too remember Tegan is extraordinary for that. I think it's probably part to do with her personality, which is a very serious, focused consciousness that she brings to reading. She's very, very serious about it. And I used to feel such a fraud because people would always, you know, quote this and, oh, I read that 10 years ago and I remember this, and I'd think, oh, I read that last year and I have no idea. Oh, that book, yeah, okay. It does somehow, I think, seem to grow. I don't know how, but I certainly remember that many years of reading, devouring, enjoying, and then forgetting. Somehow my brain is a bit of a bower bird. It does tend to pick things up, or it remembers things. And it's what you're saying earlier, you know, picking these things out. Somewhere in that weird head, it makes these connections, and I can remember certain things. Like everybody, I think you go back and you reread and you think, oh, I remembered wrongly. Or it wasn't as good as I thought, or wow, that's extraordinary, I totally missed it the first time. But if I was to write something for publication, I would read and reread the text. So if I do a review, I'll get the book, I'll read the book, and then I will go back with notepaper and pen, and then I will start doing quotes. And often what I'll do is if I'm writing a review, for instance, I will write down, or an analysis, I'll write down specific quotes from the book and put them in a document, and then I'll start to think about what story I'm going to tell, and then I'll go back and pick those out. So sometimes just the work of that lodges it more deeply in my brain anyway.
Do you mark your books? Are you an underliner?
Well, I used to, and now I'm horrified. And you know, on Twitter, well, I'm on Twitter more than Instagram, because I don't know how to use Instagram properly. You know, people say, oh, this book, and they've highlighted all these big books and annotated things. I think, oh, I hope you've got a second copy. But I used to, very much so, and now I'm sort of kind of horrified that I did. And I have had a good laugh over the years of people doing screenshots of library books and the comments of people who have borrowed the book from the library and put it in, and some being so banal, but some being so insightful, and think, wow, that's fantastic. And I'm sure writers would say, this is a conversation. The book's no longer mine. You know, you make it what you want to make it. But for me, no, I don't mark them. I'm a sticky, yellow sticky or pink sticky girl. But yeah.
Considering that we're talking about reading, I wanted to let the listeners in on a little of our correspondence this week, because I let you know that I was reading Folesbred, Gillian Mears Folesbred, for the first time. And you said in an email that you envied me this first time read and that I would either be smarting or soaring from the ending, which of course I am both. I finished it yesterday morning, and it's what an incredible book. It gave me that feeling. I've talked about this on the podcast before, but when I started studying at RMIT in the writing and editing, and I came back as mature age, so I already had my children. And in one of the subjects, someone said something about Joan Didion. And I was like, oh yeah, Joan Didion, but I've never read her. And everyone was kind of aghast. And then I read Joan Didion and I was like, how could I have gone through life without having read Didion up until this point? Yeah. And I feel the same a little bit about me, as I had read The Mint Lawn, but like, I'm so glad now I've read Folesbred, but I can't believe that I hadn't read it.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about Gillian Mears, and even though I know this is an impossible question, if there were a few words that spring to mind immediately when you think of Mears as a writer and person, what would they be?
Oh, that's not impossible at all. I'd say complex, warm, open, generous. As a writer, I'd say poetic, but I'd also say fragile, and then I'd say robust, and then I'd say self-doubting and phenomenally confident, all those things. I can't think of another person or writer that I've come across that seems to have held such contradictions within themselves and their writing and somehow carried it off.
Yes. Which is, you know, what you explore so wonderfully in the biography that you've written, Leaping Into Waterfalls. I wanted to ask to begin whether or not you as a literary biographer have to admire the writer that you're writing about, or do you only have to have strong feelings in any direction about them?
No, for me, the key is admiring the writing. Although having said, yes, no, it's admiring the writing. So I didn't ever intend to be a literary biographer, and I wrote the Garner book for a really specific reason, and that was because I noticed the continuing hostility towards her in certain circles because of The First Stone, and also that nothing had actually been written about her 40 years of work. And I thought, hang on, there's something wrong with that, because everybody knows Helen Garner, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And you think, 20 years' time, no one's going to know this woman, and there'll be a few books, but they all go out of print, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, that's not okay for the future. There just needs to be a touchstone there so that further, you know, conversations can happen. So that was the Garner one. And I really admired her nonfiction, The Joe Cinque and This House of Grief, I think she had written by the time I started to do the biography. And she had come and spoken at a seminar I had organised about ethics and writing and grief. And I liked her as a person. I thought, oh, there's something I could do here. But I seriously didn't want to touch The First Stone, but I had to. So that was my impetus there. And then I just really enjoyed the whole process. So I wanted to do it again. But the next few months I did flounder, as I'm floundering at the moment. And it's about finding a writer whose writing I considered to be good enough to interest me. Mm. And I actually hadn't read The Mint Lawn. And everyone in the world had read The Mint Lawn. And everyone says, oh, The Mint Lawn, you know, it changed me. And as a 20-year-old, I read The Mint Lawn. I hadn't read it when I started this project. I had read The Grass Sister and largely forgotten it, but when I went back and read it, I saw it. I had read Folesbred, and I had read her long essays published in Heat, the Alive in Anton Bee, which just blew my mind, and Fairy Death. So I thought, okay, Gillian Mears. So I started reading the Mint Lawn and thought, okay, yep, this writer has enough to interest me, that they're good enough. I can go and discover this work. And that was the impetus. And then, of course, I discovered there's this monster archive. So, you know, it was just sort of tick the boxes, yes, please. And
let's talk.
Turned out to be so complex. So yes. It was just great.
Let's talk about the archive. There's a great article that we'll link to that you wrote for the State Library of New South Wales, where you say that, you know, working in an archive can be an immersive and addictive experience. Oh. And you go on to describe the enormity of Mears's archive, which is 27 metres of material held in 154 boxes. Can you just give us a sense of what it is like walking into an archive like that, how to know where to begin, how you approach it, what happens?
Yeah, it's huge. So in this instance, Gillian had put in every letter, and she was a great letter writer and a letter receiver, that she had ever received without the permission of the people who had written those letters. So she did it for a number of reasons, but it caused massive grief with writers like Beth Yarp, Margot Daly, Fiona McGregor, and they just said, you know, you didn't have the right to put our letters in there, and asked her to put on a caveat to say that no one was allowed to look at those letters unless they had each author's permission. So what happened was the State Library had certain conditions. Gillian had that condition on it. The State Library had put on some other conditions as sort of protective conditions, saying you need to get the permission of every person who's got a letter in this particular archive before you can have this archive. So for instance, the first one I decided on, okay, well, I'm going to start on this box. And I had to write to probably, I think, about 32 authors at that point.
Wow.
And then wait for their responses.
Just to get in.
Just to get in. So, and all bar two said, yes, of course you can. That's not a problem whatsoever. And so then I went back with the permission slips and the letters and the emails to get the permissions. And so then the archivist said, okay, you can have this box. From then on, things relaxed. They sort of, okay, yes, you've got permissions, you can use these boxes. So to begin with, actually, the first box I got was somewhere in 1997. And it was a bit disorienting because there was lots and lots of Gillian's diaries in it. So that was easy. I could have pure access to that. But she had just split up with what I actually came to think of as the love of her life. And so there were diaries and diaries and diaries of heartbreak. And I thought, oh, what have I got myself into here? Because I've just read for 2 weeks about, you know, a woman with a broken heart. And we all know what that's like. But I thought, oh, I hope there's more than that in the archive. But from there, by the time I'd finished that box, I'd got all the permissions from everybody else I needed. So then I just went straight back to the chronological beginning and said, okay, now can you give me this one? Now can you give me this one? And just worked my way through. And really, you're not interested, well, me, I'm not interested in anything else much out there in the world except, can I just get back in now, please? So it was fine.
Tell me, Bernadette, what does the process look like for you? Because I imagine that this will be interesting both to researchers but also to any writer who's doing any kind of research. We all do so much different type of research for the work that we write. Are you synthesizing as you go through the archive? Are you note-taking? Are you using software like Scrivener? What's your process of immersing yourself and knowing that you can't afford to go back through the 154 boxes in their entirety either?
Not in their entirety, but you do go back.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, again, it's a learning process. So I learnt a large amount when I started on the Ghana book. I thought, I'm just going to take notes in my notebook. And then I thought, oh, this isn't working. So then I would put them on my laptop. So then I actually had notes in notebooks, notes on the laptop, everything. I said, this is a disaster. With the Gillian one, I had a laptop, took it in and thought, okay, everything is going in this laptop. Because I was used to going through a large archive, which was Ghana's archive, I could tell the story. So you could read all day long and there might only be a paragraph, but you think that's going to be important. And so you just have, for me, you have to, what if anyone in an archive, it's like footnotes of when you're doing your research, you don't leave them till last. Mm. So, you know, everything had the title, this was the box, this was the folder it was in, this was the year, this was the date. So everything clearly done then. And then I'd put these quotes in. When I got to the end of that, thinking that I was being really spare, that I had over 300,000 words, and that was the absolutely essential quotes, and even lots of photographs then of documents, you know, must go back and look at this, and oh, here we go. And that wasn't even analysing the works or interviewing all the people. But the story, then you go through it and you highlight it for me. I'll say you as a second person, but it's me. And it makes a story. And suddenly you start to see where this story is coming from. And it goes back to the Bowerbird stuff from earlier. You think, oh, hang on a minute. I remember that letter she wrote to someone which said something about this, and you go and find it and put it in. How it works in the end, I tried Scrivener, I downloaded it, I got it because writers had been recommending it, and I was too stupid to use it. I just thought, okay, this is not going to work for me. Maybe I'm too old. I'll just stick to Word.
I have attempted it many, many times. Maybe we both have, but no, it doesn't work for me.
Oh, that makes me feel better. So let's just say on my computer, and I think this time I'm going to stay whatever, and I have a laugh whenever writers, you know, put these notes out saying, oh, what do you call your document, you know, final document or edited document? It's like, oh, my goodness, the number of documents and subfolders I have is appalling. Every time, even though I say I'm going to keep it neat. But, and then eventually you get a structure and then you get chapters, and then I put all the notes I have for that particular chapter or whatever in a manila folder, and the quotes and interviews and whatever, and I then think, okay, I've got them vaguely organised, and then the mess is unbelievable, but it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. And you sit in it, and it's just, for me, it's that moment when that huge amount of material, suddenly you can distill it down and you think, I've got a story here. And that's the addiction. You just think, I really don't want to be known as a biographer, but actually I've got to say, I really want to do it again.
Yes, good. I'm so glad. I must say that for both of them, but particularly for Leaping Into Waterfalls, and I've seen this, you're getting this kind of feedback in reviews pages, but also on Twitter and in other places like that. This, the narrative, the urgency in it, the pace at which people, which I and other people I know read it for a literary biography, was extraordinary. And it makes sense when you think about it being distilled down from this enormous archive that you were able to piece together this extraordinary kind of story from that. Tell us about the interviews as well. So it's not only the archive. You then go out and go places, meet people, talk to people. Tell us about that part of the process, Bernadette.
Yeah, I'll go back just to start for one point, what you just said then about distilling it down and the pace. Hazel Rowley once spoke about writing a biography, and she said, there's no such thing as a boring life, and it's not okay as a biographer to write in a boring way, because what you've done is make people think the writer was boring if you're writing about a writer. So basically, do better. So I had that in mind, and I thought, also, this story is so big and a lot of it is very dark. And so I thought, I have to tell it in a way that respects Gillian but keeps the reader absolutely engrossed. So it has to be a page turner, and the end of each chapter I had to just distill down and think, okay, don't put that in. Don't put that paragraph in. You can tell people that in interviews or something, but don't put it in here, just because it's to send them back to Gillian's work. That's my idea. Mm. So there was that one. Interviews. All I can say is, for any researcher who is thinking, I might do something like this, I can thoroughly recommend it, because the interviews are such a privilege and they're so much fun. And you just get to meet all these people that you would never meet in your whole life. And you actually get to be friends with some of them, which is fantastic. They are draining, and some of them are very difficult. A number of them with Gillian's partners, with her family, were incredibly exhausting. And I would often come back from the Northern Rivers region really drained and flat. The way I got myself back on the horse every time, so to speak, was I would watch a few minutes of a video of Gillian in interview or something, or I'd hear her talk, or I'd listen to her reading Alive in Antonbean. I think, yeah, I can do this, I can do this. But the interviews, my tip, if anyone's going out to do them, and the way I do it, is I put them off until I'm absolutely across the material, because I don't want to waste a second, but I also don't want to disrespect my subject or my interviewee. So when you were saying earlier about reading and then forgetting the book of what you read, both times I've done these biographies in the early years, months maybe, I've thought, oh, I'm never going to get across this. I can't remember. When did she publish that? Or when did this happen? Oh, God, I've got to go back and look again. And suddenly you get to probably 2 years in and someone mentions an essay. Oh, well, that was June 2000 or something or other, anything. It's just all there. That's the point when I then go and interview people. It's when I've gone through the whole archive, when I started to think about structure, when I've looked at different things, thought, okay, now I'm going to go and talk to them. Everyone does interviews differently. Some people record, some people take notes. I do take a notebook and a pen, but I try and keep eye contact with the person. So I'll scribble a few things, or later on I'll write things and then I'll check with them later. But to meet some of these people is just such a privilege. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this time I got to talk to Bruce Pascoe. I got to talk to Ma Grounds, who then died, you know, the next year. I got to meet all of Gillian's family. I got to meet most of her ex-lovers. And it's fascinating because what happens when I, as the interviewer, go into these people's lives is I churn it all up again. Mm. And a lot of them were very churned up, and a lot of them continued to contact me through the next year or so that I was writing. Oh, look, I just found this, or I just found a photo, or I just found a letter, or here's my diary, or whatever. So you make human connections, which for me is really important. Mm. I love it.
What's the technical process that you go through in terms of those interviews in allowing people to have a look at sections of the text of the manuscript that where you've written about them? As you're speaking, I'm seeing the complexity of where you come in as biographer. Here's Gillian or Garner, and here's you, and here's all these other people, and the shifting point of view and allegiance you must feel.
Yes.
What's the technical kind of work that you must go through in a biography to get all those things checked off?
Yeah, well, you put your finger on it there. The allegiances you feel, you move all the time, which is challenging but also kind of exciting in the end. So I think legally you are obliged to make sure if you're quoting anyone, you have shown them the quotes that you're going to do. I, because of the person I am, have wanted to not offend too many people, but also want to tell the truth. So there's a lot of things I've left out of each biography because I just think it's not my business to push this, and there's still people living that can be very hurt. But what I've done each time is if I've quoted someone significantly or they're a major player, I've sent them their quotes that I'm quoting with some context, but not all the context, because they don't actually have that right. Mm. They can complain once I've written it if they like, but I'm the biographer and I'm writing the story. So, but you do have to write and say, do you approve of these lines, and do you approve of that? And this time, yes, everyone agreed and said, yes, that's okay. Interestingly, there was one beautiful woman just an extraordinary woman that I got to meet, very gentle, lovely woman, and she got the book and she read the little bit where she was quoted and sent me a text immediately. It was late at night. Said, oh, look, I've just read those few pages, and while I said those things to you, I think you've portrayed me too harshly and this isn't okay. And so I was mortified, absolutely mortified, and said, well, please, she said, I haven't read the rest of the book yet. I said, oh, well, please, read the book. I'm happy to talk with you. We'll have a conversation. You know, if it goes to a second print run, I can probably, you know, change that if there's a real problem with this, blah, blah. Fortunately, she said, I'm a very slow reader. Fortunately, she read for a long time. And then I got the most beautiful email saying, oh, I wouldn't change a thing. Please, no, it's great. It's perfect. I see it now. It all fits in beautifully. But there are those moments when you think, I can't be everything to everyone. This is a story and there is damage in this story and people will be more damaged. So all I can do is try and limit the damage from my perspective, from my, you know, my intervention in a way. That's just me.
That makes me think too about your relationship with your subjects, because you've got two such extraordinary subjects in Garner and Mears. Garner is, of course, still alive and you're having conversations with her, as well as the fact that she has gone on to publish her own diaries as well. So there's that part of the conversation. With Mears, obviously, is no longer alive, but she was quite aware, it seems, in her archives that someone would come along and be her biographer. So there was that conversation as well. How did you find those two separate processes and your relationship, I suppose, with your subjects?
Yeah, great question. Relationships with subjects was very different, and I was intrigued by it because, well, firstly with Garner, it was that she insisted that she didn't want a biography. And so I didn't really want to write one. I thought, I'm really not interested in delving into people's private lives. I don't really want to know. So it was a fairly easy way to get around that, to just structure the book around her publications and do that sort of literary thing and stay away from things I didn't need to go towards. And it's just fantastic when she then publishes a diary and I think, hey, I left all of that bit out. But it wasn't mine to tell. That's fine. You've told that. That's excellent. Tick, that goes well. And over the time of meeting her, so when we first started, she said to me, I sent her, I think, an email and said, I don't suppose you'd let me have a look at your archive. And it was sort of, oh, my God, what's in it? I put it in there for tax reasons. Oh, my God, I'm so anxious. You know, you better come and have a bowl of soup. So after about 5 hours of chatting over a bowl of soup, she says, oh, you can have access to everything. And we then developed a real friendship over the years. But of course but she didn't interfere in anything. I had to keep distance and she didn't interfere in anything. And in fact, it's a funny story. Probably 6 months before I published it, she rings me up and says, hey, BB, I've just been thinking, you better get some people to say some bad things about me. You need to get some people who really hate me. And then says, oh, maybe you already have. You know, that's terrible. You know, maybe I'm interfering here. I said, it's okay. And I said, there's a lot of people that don't really want to say anything. Oh, hang on. She said, give me a day. I'll think up some people who really hate me and I'll send you, you know, their numbers or whatever. So that was actually very funny. But she didn't interfere and she didn't want to know anything. And she was the first to read the manuscript because I'd used private stuff. But Gillian was a different story. She was dead. And there was something in me that felt a responsibility to her. And I think it was to do that she was 18 months younger than me. Mm. And I'd met her once, but, you know, I didn't know her. And very early on, her sister Yvonne took me out to her grave and it's beautiful. And I was really moved and I felt a sense of responsibility and thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can pull it off. I don't know if I can write a book about you, but I'll give it a shot. And there was a connection in that I felt responsible to do my best and to do my best by her. So when her sister Karen says she would have loved it, she would have had to have found something that she hated. She always found something she hated. She said, yeah, she wouldn't have liked her ears on the photo on the cover. I said, yeah, I've heard that from a few people. So it was an interesting relationship. And there were times when I really didn't like Gillian. There were times I thought, I just can't bear this anymore. And really, you know, but as I said, I'd watch a video again or I'd come back to it or I'd just go back to the writing and think, no, that's, and then I was back again. So complex relationships with subjects, but they do invade your life, your thinking. You see things everywhere that remind you of that. You dream them. It becomes encompassing, which is great in some ways and then kind of a relief when it ends.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you a little bit about self-care as a biographer, as a researcher. There was a time you and I were corresponding briefly about Ghana's archives and you made a note that some of them were particularly hard going, particularly yeah. while she was writing This House of Grief. And I know you've spoken about the same with some of the material in Mears's archive. What kinds of boundaries do you establish or what kinds of things do you do for yourself as the writer and researcher when you are kind of wading through some of that darker, heavier material?
For me, I go into the ocean, I swim, I walk my dog. I used to leave the State Library every afternoon, kind of rush home and grab the dog. Come on, off we go. it's as simple as that. I happen to have a pretty bounce back personality. I'm lucky. I don't suffer from depression. I don't suffer from anxiety, although I have become increasingly introverted over the last few years, I suppose, because of COVID, I suppose, because of research, I suppose, getting older, I don't know. So I don't take it on board too much. But there were times, yes, with each one when I found it almost overwhelming. Mm. And I mentioned in that State Archive one that my husband actually had to go to work for in England. And I said, right, I looked it up and I met a woman who was from Iceland and she said, look, they, in Iceland, every town has a pool. and I'm a great swimmer. You're kidding me. No, you swim through winter. It's all thermally heated from the volcanoes. Right, I'm going to Iceland. So I did. I went for 8 days. He came with me. We hired a car and we literally just drove to 8 different towns and swam every day in whatever pool was there and then came home. And I needed it because my head was just so full of darkness at that time. And it's funny because at the moment we're watching Scandi Noir, we're watching Trapped on SBS On Demand, and it's, you know, the ice and the snow and the darkness. Something to think I went there to escape my dark head, but it was wonderful.
As you're saying that, I'm seeing a new kind of OZCO fellowship for writers in the midst of any project where they just get flown to Iceland and they go around and they swim in different pools and then they come home and they're ready and refreshed to get back to the work. Refreshed.
It takes a week. Yes. You need a lot of frequent fly points to get over there.
I really like that. This morning I was listening to a post-Valentine's Day conversation on the radio where someone was reading back their unsent love letters, and the conversation kind of moved on to the regret about the fact that we don't necessarily write long letters anymore and that we're in this age of kind of fleeting communications and communications that are sometimes designed to disappear. Exactly. And not be held in the archive. Yeah. And I asked Garner about this as well, about this move away from the handwritten letter. Mm-hmm. And what it means for the archive. So as someone who has found so much extraordinary material in correspondence between writers and great thinkers, how are future researchers going to deal with our lack of kind of handwritten correspondence, and what does it mean for what we understand about writers and their relationships, do you think?
I have no idea where it's going to go, and I just figure everything in the future is going to be so different, and maybe there won't be such things as literary biographies, and maybe even writers become more ephemeral and their books are all on e-books anyway or something. I don't know, but I do know that Gillian resisted emails for a long time, and then she had to use them because she couldn't move her hands, so she had voice recognition. And the emails did the trick, and they were actually quite good because when they're printed out, they've got the date and time and everything on them. So you think, okay, that really works very well. But she also put in reams and reams of text messages. And as a researcher, I found that unbearable. It just, you know, I'll be 10 minutes late. Okay, I'll meet you at the gate. I'll do this. And so you're reading this. You think, if you look back on your phone, you think the number of banal text messages you write, and you think, surely no one would be expected to trawl through that. So it is a real issue, but there's nothing we can do about it because that's how the world is. Mm. And maybe writers of the future aren't even going to be interested in letters anyway because they're all quickly sending an Insta or they're doing something more.
Do you think we're losing something in that drilling down or the speed then at which we can kind of unravel those thoughts that we might have in those kinds of, correspondences? Do you think that we are missing out on something?
Definitely. And in fact, Gillian had this policy that people needed to chew over her letters. Mm. And if they responded too quickly, she was furious. So how can you possibly respond the next day or immediately? Because you needed to chew over my letter for, 2 weeks, and then you could write me a 8-page missive, in response. And she would do that. She would take a letter, and a letter would have to be only focused on, nothing else, in a certain space for a while, and then be reread and then be responded to. And it's like everything we read in correspondence, isn't it? If you go back to the email you fire off or the tweet you put out there, you think, oh, my gosh, really shouldn't have done that, or I really should have thought that through more carefully, or actually, isn't that interesting? I was obviously saying X and I didn't realise I was doing that. If we did slow down, if we did do things, but I think that ship has long sailed and it's just not going to happen. No, I don't know what that means. It's one of the advantages, I think, of getting old. I think, oh, dear, I won't have to deal with that.
I don't have to worry about that particular thing. That's true. We'll take it off our list. I want to ask a really practical question, Bernadette. I'm reading at the moment and loving Gabrielle Chan's Why You Should Give a Fuck About Farming. And as I was reading it, I thought, my gosh, this is, this is basically a PhD in a book. This must have taken so long, the kind of research that has been undertaken. Yeah. And it made me think, well, how do you pitch a book like this? How do you financially, get the support you need to do a work like this? How on earth do our nonfiction writers kind of make this all work? What's the kind of logistics of pitching a nonfiction work like the ones that you've done and getting it through to publication?
Okay, well, I'm not the person to ask because I've had it way too easy.
No, it's good. I love this transparency.
Yeah, it's so hard. But for me, for example, with the Ghana one, when I said I was going to do it, Michael Haywood contacted me and said, can you come have another bowl of soup?
Right. Excellent. I need to have more bowls of soup, obviously.
Mind you, I do like soup. And so he was pushing to sign me up for a contract. And I was saying, no, I don't want one. I don't want a contract. I don't know if I can write this book. I want to be free to do it, blah, blah, blah. He didn't take no for an answer. So I had a contract with Text pretty quickly and said, yes, okay, I'll deliver that. Second time round with the Gillian, my contract was still with Text, you know, as for a second book. So I knew that that would happen. And Michael said, I will publish anything you write. But he wasn't as keen on Gillian, obviously, as he was on Helen. And then Jane Palfreyman was very keen and said, I would like to publish on Gillian. So I said, okay, I'm not having any contracts with anyone because I don't know if I can do it and I don't want the pressure. And then I got Jane Novak as my agent. And then when I knew I could do it, when I had half the book written, I wrote an introduction and the first six chapters, say, and sent them off to Jane and said, okay, now you can do whatever. And Michael very graciously said, look, I know her heart's with Ellen and Unwin because they were Gillian's publisher and Jane had been her publisher. So that's fine. I'll let it go. She can go to Ellen Unwin. So that is a dream run.
I was just about to say, what a delightful story about publishing in this country.
And I could afford to do that without, you know, needing that advance in that first time, which most writers cannot do. So I really am not the person for advice, but I do think if you've got an idea, it's the nonfiction idea, if you can even just do two or three chapters, if the writing in those chapters is interesting enough and you get through to, you pick your publishers, I think, you need to do the bit of research and think who would be interested in this. And I get asked that a lot by writers, who do you think I should send this to? And I think, well, that's obviously a textbook, or that's obviously, you know, that could be a Black Ink, or that could be here. So you do a bit of research on that. And I do get a lot of conversations with publishers who say, what do you think about this? Or can you have a read of this? And they do care. It's just a matter of getting through. But again, I say less is more, as in type words, spend your time working on that first bit, send that through, and you just might get a contract. That might be just talking through my app. I don't know.
Yeah, that's great advice. I knew that there wouldn't be scope in this interview to go deep on both Ghana and Mears. And in fact, I just urge any of our listeners who have not yet read A Writing Life, Helen Garner and her work, or Leaping into Waterfalls, to go out and read them immediately, because of not because they're just wonderful books, but also because they're what they teach you about writing. But I did want to ask you to comment on one of the kind of powerful synergies that I read, and I think lots of people have read, between Garner and Mears in those works, which is this extraordinary hunger for the world and for the experiences of the world and for wanting connection and to be deep in everything around them that Ghana mm-hmm. and Mears shared. Mm-hmm. And I've in the past couple of years been involved in lots of conversations with particularly women writers about, you know, wanting and wanting more. And I think everyone thinks this is a conversation they're having for the first time, but in fact, maybe this has been the lot of particularly women artists for all time. Can you just comment on that thread in their lives and works?
Yes, it's so important, isn't it? And I think it's to do with having a large imagination and wanting, as you say, that experience. Just, can I please have more? I just watched The Lost Daughter finally on Netflix, and it's disturbed me in ways, extraordinary ways, even though I've read the book. Mm. And I am in awe of how Maggie Gyllenhaal managed to translate it into, you know, how do you have Olivia Colman playing this lead role? Thing. Why are they in Greece? Hang on. But they did it. But it's, again, it's the same theme. It's a brilliant, creative woman cannot have it all. Mm. And yet we've all been told that we can. Mm. And a lot of us manage, but as I always say, once you have children, for example, you learn the word compromise in a capital C, and the structural inequalities in the world that stop women having the chances that men do, you know, and you think of Drusilla Modescu's Stravinsky's Lunch, you think the men geniuses and the women, oh, you're just writing this kind of stuff. And yet there are women everywhere, particularly creative women, screaming inside for that experience and expressing that experience and trying to capture as much of it as they can. But of course, then thinking, but I need to be nice, or I am a mother, or I am a wife, or I am something. So I'll play that role and I'll do this. I reckon everything I've ever written should be titled In the Margins. And I think that's about for every other creative woman. It's in the margins of everything else you have to do and you know, fit for some women. Oh, sorry, that's my dog.
Absolutely fine.
For some women, it's in the margins because I have to work to eat. You know, I can't survive on this as a creative artist. So I think that impulse, and Gillian was the same. She didn't have much money. She had disabilities increasingly, making it increasingly difficult for her to live and function. But she would compromise by setting up with various lovers who could give her some kind of structure so she could write. So there has to be a kind of brutal streak in each, and I think there was in Ghana and Mia's, that says, bugger this, I want to write and I'm going to write. And if I need to experience life to write, I'm going to do that too. So good on them. I'm glad they did.
So am I. Bernadette, I listened back to a really interesting panel you did last year online for Sydney Writers Festival in COVID times, not that we're out of them yet, with Declan Fry and Katrina Menzies-Pike, in which you were discussing the culture of reviewing in this particular time we are in which critics are criticised for being too soft or too hard, for negative reviews, for not divulging conflicts of interest, at the same time as review pages are shrinking and things like, you know, the pandemic have meant a truly difficult time for writers. I want to ask just for your take on where we are and perhaps why we are where we are and how might we go forward in review culture in a way that doesn't polarise kind of opinion and cause these tiny little wars on Twitter that we all think are so enormous until we realise they're just oscillate on Twitter and that's a different thing entirely. You know, what's happening?
What's happening? I guess it's the anxiety of the marketplace and the anxiety of publishers and, you know, I guess that's always going to be the way and it always has been the way, and the horror that writers earn $3,000 a year up to, wow, $12,000 a year. Well, you know, don't spend it all at once. So publishers go into bat for their writers too keenly, perhaps, because I think the writers are okay and the books stand for themselves and whatever. I do think critics need to be absolutely honest in their criticism. They need to say, this book doesn't work. If you really hate it that much, then either don't review it or explicitly state why you hate it that much. You know, or for instance, you know, when Jessie Tu did that review, she expressed very clearly her opinion and why she hated, you know, the book. My take on that was, that's fine, that's your opinion, you can say that. But I think for your own sake, you were probably a bit too emotive. And again, I think we all do this. I'm guilty of it. The number of times I fight, not for publishing criticism, but, you know, having a fight with someone or putting something on Twitter, you're so incensed and you say these things and you think, it's always better to just step back, breathe, why am I so angry? Do this in a way that can express it to other people why I'm so angry, rather than that personal attack. I think we've got some great critics in this country. I think the anxiety of a critic sinks a book is probably too intense. I think a critic can sink a play. And I did do a couple of reviews of plays and I felt really, really strung out at the thought that, of course, no performance is perfect except one I saw from Neil LaBute years ago where I still am in awe. And yet you think the difficulty of staging a play in these times, if a critic pans it, that's just terrible. So it's difficult, but I think in one sense you could say reviews don't carry that much weight. Word of mouth carries that much weight. David Malouf always says a writer will find its reader, and you know, a book will find its reader. And yes, maybe that's pie in the sky, but to a certain extent, word of mouth, or increasingly Instagram, Twitter, Facebook will say, read this book. I think we're always going to have these little wars. I think people are going to be anxious. But I think we just need to think that is a particular critic. That's that critic's brand. That's how that critic writes. Do I like that critic's approach? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe what that critic has said over time, I think I didn't like that book or this book or that book, so maybe that critic's not for me. And that's fine. That's people should just own their voice and know it. So that's my take on it. So.
Very interesting. And I urge people to go back to that conversation too. We'll put a link into it because there's lots of other interesting things that both you and Declan and Katrina unpacked.
Just to say that conversation, it was just a one-on-one with Katrina and I. And then I didn't know Declan was going to be spliced in, but a couple of people said to me, oh, that conversation you had with Declan.
It's not a conversation with Declan. That's very true. And it's quite clear too, because there are a couple of times I was like, oh, I'll comment on that. Oh, no, I can see now that they were recorded absolutely separately. But those kinds of conversations, you know, I think are really, it's part of this, what I feel is a real a beginning to open up and be a bit more transparent about the industry in all its aspects, which is helpful for all parts of the industry, I think, you know, to talk about review culture, to talk about money, to talk about how publicity works, et cetera. I think it's useful for everyone. On that, I don't know how much you can talk about being a judge on the Miles Franklin, but I'm interested mostly, I think you mentioned at the start that you're up to the end of your term. So how long is a term as a judge for the Miles Franklin?
Well, it was nominally 5 years, but I don't think it was written in the clause properly. So as of I think last year or the year before, it's now written in, which is a good thing. And it's an interesting thing because, for instance, the Stella changes every year. Personally, I think that could be problematic. I think maybe 2 years would be ideal. You certainly don't want judges staying on a judging committee too long, and maybe 5 years is a little bit too long. You need to sweep it out, new ideas, because everybody reads differently, has different opinions. So it's 5 years is the term now.
And how many judges are there, Bernadette?
Five.
Five of you for 5 years. And you said 100, how many books have you read this
year? Well, last year there was 108. Okay. This year there was 96, but we've called for another two that weren't entered, and there's another four coming. So that'll be 102.
I love this. I know this because I've heard it from a number of different people now, but perhaps our listeners aren't aware of this, that a judging panel can call for books if they haven't been entered. How did they come to light? How does that, obviously, without being specific?
It is part of being a judge on these kinds of awards. You do need to know what's going on, and you need to know which books are around and be engaged in that kind of thing. So as I was reading through, and the boxes arrive and they arrive and they arrive. Oh, here we go through another box. And suddenly you think, well, hang on a minute, where's that book? And where's this book? And so then, you know, recently I sent an email to my co-judges saying, hey, I think we should call for this book. It hasn't been entered. And another judge said, oh, well, what about this book? And so we write to the publishers and say, excuse me, you haven't put this book in. I think you should. And I know that happened years ago when I was on the ALS. Oh, my goodness, this is amazing. It's just come to me. I was on the ALS gold medal. I was the chair of that. And Alan and Unwin didn't submit their books for the deadline. And I wrote to them twice. And finally I said, you know, could you please submit these books? I know you've got some good ones. And that was when False Bread was submitted.
Oh, wow.
It was just a hitch in their system at the time. But as a judge, I think you've got a responsibility to writers to also think, well, I'm not just going to read what you give me. And there's an awful lot that gets sent in, which I don't think should get sent in. But you do need to know what's around, and you do need to be respectful of writers to think, well, for some reason your publisher hasn't sent your book and I actually think it's worth considering, so we'll call for it and we'll read it.
You and the other judges are in a position of being able to note over that time the kinds of trends, I suppose, is a kind of a clunky word to use it, but the types of books that you might be seeing, the stories that are being told in Australian literature over that time, are there things that are coming up that are noticeable to you as being common or being different in, you know, each year?
Yes, there are. And I was amazed last year the sheer number of books that seemed to be telling stories going back to the outback, going back to the bush. I thought, goodness, what's going on here? It really quite blew my mind. I was staggered. And also last year there was not so many what I would call bold books. There wasn't so many experimental books. And I thought, That's interesting. I didn't know if it was, you know, obviously it's a lead time of however long someone takes to write a book, whether it's 3, 5 years, 9 years, whatever. This year there are quite a number of books that are, and last year as well, actually. Last year had quite a few books of child sexual abuse. This year that theme has continued. There's also an interest in end of life, in voluntary assisted dying. I'm just trying to remember them all without, you know, doing so.
Yes.
A number of books have trans characters this year. And it's the first time I've seen a significant number where we'll have a trans character. So these sorts of things, you know, start to come through and you start to see them in, you know, book after book. Sometimes there's sort of, last year there was two or three books that had almost the same plot. And,
wow.
And it was kind of weird. Wow, that's amazing. These writers are in the zeitgeist, or they're thinking about the same things. Or, but yeah.
Do you think that lit prizes work, Bernadette? Do you think that they're fair? Do you think they're a good thing in the...
Yes, I'm very conflicted about this, because you just think, I have, you know, been a judge on these prizes for so many years, and I think in one sense I don't want to be. In the other sense, you think I have a responsibility to read these books, to put in the time, to acknowledge writers. I would like to see long lists absolutely celebrated, and I'd like to see short lists, you know, dancing from the ceilings. In my experience of a number of different awards, there is usually, in just in the times I've been the judge, the winner has usually stood out, and usually stood out fairly early. Although, having said that, I can honestly say in the Miles Franklin, it has nearly always come down to a whisker between one or the other. So there's often two. You know, that's just, I don't think that's betraying confidences. I can say that. Do they work? So my point about that being that the winner should be celebrated, but the shortlist should be absolutely celebrated. And when I say, you know, over 100 novels get sent in, if you have a shortlist of 12, that's 12 novels that 5 people have read and said, these are worthy, they go somewhere. Mm. And I like to put people on long lists when they've written a good book, and that it's also encouraging. It's also saying to people, excuse me, can you notice this writer, please, so that the next time they write a book, the publisher says, oh, you were longlisted, all right, I'll read your manuscripts. And for me, that's how I like a prize to work, not just for someone winning the prize, but for writers to get access to the industry and say, look, I wrote this book and you should back me. So that's my personal approach.
Yeah. I love it. I feel like we're going deep down into the world. I'm so grateful for your generosity in speaking to me, Bernadette. I can't let you go without asking you, what is jumping out of the archive next for you? What is your thinking? Who are we going to see next?
Oh,
what archives are kind of buzzing away in there, ready to be opened up?
Well, there's a couple, but I just don't know. I mean, I keep saying I just don't want to be known as a biographer, but I... You know, as I say, I've just started reading Brenda Niles' book, and she didn't mean to be a biographer either, and she did 9 biographies. So there's a couple, and a few people have contacted me, but I'm just reading around at the moment and seeing if I get captivated enough, if it can work. So I won't say anything too much just
yet. All right, we will watch this space. Incredible advice already during this interview, but if there was one piece of advice that you could pass on to writers coming up in the Australian industry, can you think of one that you would pass on?
I'd just say back yourself. Just have the guts. My one piece of advice that I've certainly used to give to my students, my PhD students, and myself when I was writing, the delete button is often your best friend. If you can let your ego go enough, your story will shine. You let things go. So, you know, when I gave my manuscript on Ghana to Hayward, he said, okay, lose 35,000 words and then I'll read it. And so 6 days later, I sent it back with 35,000 less words. And
wow.
People say, how did you do that? So, well, you just let your ego go. And part of it is when you're, you know, doing a PhD or something, you think, I have to show off that I know everything, that I've read everything, that I've got everything in there. But just think about your reader. That's it. That's my one bit of advice. Trust your reader. Any book I pick up, where something is over-explained or something said, and then they just give me that little extra bit. I think, oh, please don't. Please don't. Trust your reader, and that way I will engage with you as the writer, and I will do my own work, and therefore the book will stay with me. So Perfection. Trust your reader, and less is more.
Bernadette, can you leave us with a recommendation of a debut book, any time, any genre?
Oh, there's so many. I have just a few weeks ago read Mandy Beaumont's The Furies, which is a novel, and I would say it's gutsy, it's bold. She tries new things with grammar. She's passionate, and it stayed with me. It's really haunted me. So,
Bernadette, such a pleasure to speak with you. I feel like we could have done a couple of hours on there. So let's hope that we get to speak again in the future. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was a privilege and a pleasure.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.